Much to my delight upon researching regenerative organic certified farms, I came across CR Medicinal Farms in Costa Rica. And when I called, I was speaking with Rick Scalzo. Rick is the founder of Gaia Herbs as well, and his passion for people, plants, and planet has been front and center since the awareness for organic and herbal medicine really started taking hold here in the U.S. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for April 2024. Join us, grab your earbuds and/or a shovel, and let's dig in. Rick, before we get into the skinny of your Regen Certified Medicinal Herb Farm in Costa Rica, your personal history as a naturopath and developer and owner of Gaia Herbs is too big to not have you share a bit about your beginnings, which really coincided with the development of the organic herb use and business in America. What did you hold as absolutes in developing your company, Gaia?
Well, you know, it actually started back in 1987, and we were, I was in a very busy naturopathic herbal practice at the time, became far too busy for me to manage. I was doing all of the patient assessments, and I was doing pulse diagnosis, iris diagnosis, and looking at evaluating blood lab workups, and you know, I was just so busy. And then on top of it, I was going out wildcrafting and making the medicines for the patients. And it just became a, you know, all in one service. So I decided that, you know, I'm going to just start a company. And, you know, I had completed my herbal and naturopathic herbal studies. And I thought, I'll start a company and we'll make 7 rejuvenative elixirs. And that was the start of Gaia. And it became more of an opportunity for me to kind of share my philosophy and my wisdom about plants and healing to people, mostly in New England at the time. That was how Gaia started, in a local way, regional way. And so, you know, that coupled with my spiritual background and all the years I put into spiritual development really formed a narrative of how I approach my connection to nature and to plants and to healing. You know, it's all about people, plants, and planet. And so how I approached it was really through a power of observation, where I allowed myself enough of space, enough of time to be with the plants and to be inspired by the plants, but more so, not just about their therapeutic value, but about how I can connect to the greater wisdom found in nature by being present with the plants. So that wisdom is, you know, permeating everything, and it shaped the language that I used for Gaia, and it shaped, you know, my personal, you know, attitude and presence with herbs. So when people would hear me speak at the time, I was always talking about deeper philosophical principles right. That are found in nature, and how those principles become expressed in our food and in our medicine.
When you come at something from a depth and a presence, which of course both feed off of each other, it's no surprise that you were able to grow such a business. Moving into how you made your elixirs, I know that you sought out the vital force of the plants, and a lot of the herb companies were using dried herbs, which of course are good, but you wanted something more. Considering that, I'm wondering if you could just share a little bit about that, but also how has the technology been able to improve moving into today?
Interesting. Yeah, you know, you're right. When we started, when I started Gaia, I was really adamant about using fresh herbs only, because I did want to capture the full vital force of the plant. To me, this was an important construct from naturopathic medicine. So I really wanted to, you know, not lose anything. I wanted all the intelligence that was present in the plant into these elixirs. So yeah, and it did shape, you know, the language. It shaped so much. But, you know, after what, 30 years of Speaking in providing herbal medicines, the technology is very different today. And one of the things that I find is the herbal industry has really evolved in a way that I'm not so proud of, because a lot of herbal products now include purified, isolated, structurally elucidated ingredients. So that means if you have a full spectrum of phytochemistry in a plant, a lot of the more popular ingredients are purified out of the plant. And so it's nothing less than a phytochemical.
It's a drug. Yeah, it's just like the drug process.
It's a phytochemical in a pharmaceutical model. And I've always been a real advocate of full spectrum potency. And I wanted to represent the total phytochemical profile of the plants. And that has really been my forte ever since. And I've never deviated from that. We have a little helicopter flying very close by. There's a helipad right behind me.
And here I was expecting toucans or something.
Yeah, I know. If we were just from my house, we would have seen toucans. But now I'm really finding that if you can grow crops regeneratively, you can increase the phytodensity, the density of the phytochemicals, and let nature do some of this standardization. That's been my language. Let nature do the concentration. And we have found through regenerative farming, you will get 2 to 4 times more potency of phytochemical in the plants with all of the natural, synergistic chemistries present. So that I love. That's for me, tapping into the real wisdom of nature.
Yes, I love that as well. And I sincerely appreciate those efforts in that direction that you've taken throughout your career. And that brings up 2 things for me. One is I used to subscribe to the Townsend newsletter for doctors and patients. And one day it came and I opened it up and all of these ads fell out of it. They had these supplemental ads. And I just looked at them all and I got that feeling of what you were just talking about, these single diluted properties that were taken out of something natural. And I canceled my subscription to the Townsend newsletter because I thought, no, I'm just not doing this right now. But then the other thing it brings up is about your Institute for Biological Research. What would you like to tell us about that?
Yeah. So when I sold Gaia, which was 5 years ago now, I immediately went to fulfill a promise that I made to Dr. Paul Mittman, who is the president of Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, which is now Sonoran University of Health Sciences, still a naturopathic school. And 15 years ago, we were just reminiscing about this at Expo West just recently, but 15 years ago, I said to Dr. Mittman, I would love to see herbal medicine be kind of under the roof of a naturopathic college to really validate and substantiate mm-hmm. the science behind and also the language behind herbal medicine. And when I sold Gaia, I was able to provide the resources to the university to build the Rick Scalzo Institute of Botanical Research there. And we did. And it's become now a research institute with, 8 or 10 lab technicians and scientists, and a very large amount of very sophisticated lab instruments and testing equipment for doing, research that's not generally done on herbal products. And that is using bioassay cell line testing on human cell lines to test the herbs to see their safety, their absorbability or bioavailability, and their efficacy. So we've started this institute, and with this new line that I'm launching, we're testing all of the products at the institute. And this kind of became clear when we built the institute out. We had suddenly COVID emerged, and we found ourselves having to do COVID research. And we were fortunate to collaborate with Arizona State University to obtain the live COVID virus. So we tested about 80 different herbs against COVID virus in the lab and found there were eight of them that really seemed very, very active. And so we began to develop those herbs into a unique formulation for, I'm not supposed to say this, but, you know, for, you know what. So in any event, it was very successful.
Bravo.
Yeah.
So when you talk about entourage formulations getting easier to make, does an herb always work better in concert with other herbs? Does the potentiality become more than the sum of its parts?
You know, this is traditionally how it was done in China. When you make herbal formulas, you usually extract them as a formula and not as individual ingredient. And when I was at Gaia, we actually had a full study on this topic of entourage. And we looked at how much more potential there was in extracting the herbs as a formula rather than as single ingredients. So that was amazing, because we found about a 30 to 40% lift in phytoactivity. Mm. You actually extracted herbs together. So there's something about one herb being able to activate the potential of another. And it's as though these plants are speaking to each other.
I was going to say, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some herbs are still harvested in the wild. They're wild crafted. And I know saffron is one of these herbs. I guess it's grown agriculturally in Spain a lot, and yet it's wild crafted a lot as well. Do you ever test these plants, and are the medicinal or other properties very different
between a cultivated herb and a wild crafted herb?
Yes.
Yeah, we've done a lot of that, and I would not say you can draw some distinct, predictable conclusion case after case after case, but oftentimes we found that with wildcrafted herbs, we could get more phytoactivity. It was not always the case, because, you know, when you're wildcrafting, you don't know how old that herb is or how mature it's become in the ground. You only see it there. And if a wildcrafter is out foraging, he or she will harvest it. But, you know, so there are opportunities to both wildcrafting and organically cultivating herbs. I was just having this conversation, Robin, with a herb supplier and manufacturer at Expo West about what are the limitations of wildcrafting and what are the limitations of cultivation. And there seem to be now, because, you know, going back 30 years, we didn't have the demand for herbs that we have now. If we were to rely on wildcrafted populations for the demand we have now, we would have depleted the species.
Definitely.
And we would have disturbed the ecosystem. And, you know, so many, you know, negative aspects of the practice of wildcrafting would have become more visible. And it's just not a sustainable practice when you talk about a very growing herb community. And this is why I love regenerative agriculture, because the idea of a no-till or low-till practice, you know, where we're not disturbing the tilth of the earth, you know, we can be as gentle on the soil as possible to, you know, we're in partnership with the microbiome in the soil. So we don't want to really have a detrimental effect when we're growing or harvesting herbs on our microbiome.
Of course.
Yeah. I think it can be done. And now with the emergence of these practices in regenerative agriculture, I'm seeing that it can be done.
Yeah, certainly. And is there something you'd like to say about ROC before we start talking details about your farm down there in Costa Rica?
Well, I would say that the regenerative organic certification, that's what ROC stands for, is very real. Their purpose is very, very purposeful in terms of people, plants, planet. And, you know, the kind of practices that we adopt in regenerative agriculture are such that, A, we're tending to the soil food web. That means we're tending to all the microbiology in the soil and, you know, protecting it, growing it, and enabling it to work in harmony with the plants. And that has such a ripple effect downstream, and from not just the soil, but increasing nutrient and phytochemical density in the plant, and allowing us who consume the plants to benefit from enhanced, nutrient, phytochemical, and microbiome densities. And also being able to watch how the plants are metabolizing new chemicals that are essential for the body that we haven't been getting because the way our crops, our food has been grown through chemical agriculture, we're lacking necessary chemicals, amino acids, that are essential for our immunity and longevity. And, when you start repairing the bacteria and fungi, the beneficial ones in the soil, then the plants can start to manufacture these these essential nutrients again. And that has tremendous ripple down effects.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, since you have such a sentient connection to plants, above and before any connection as far as let's find out what medicinal properties they have and that sort of thing, can you speak to how you've seen the intelligence of a plant? How do you connect to that? And just as someone who eats better food can have a better capacity for life, for intellect, for learning, for all of it, does the magic come out to you more when you see plants that are really being taken care of in the soil?
It's a wonderful question and an amazing observation, because this has been, for me, this has been so real. And, watching how plants can live in partnership with us, and how we can live in partnership with plants. But that's taking it even a step further. And, what we're really talking about now is living in partnership with the beneficial, bacteria, protozoa, fungi in the soil, the arthropods, the micropods. All of these beneficial organisms are now part of the partnership, part of the collaboration. And so suddenly our awareness with regenerative agriculture is extending beyond just, growing healthy plants. It's growing healthy soil.
Yeah.
And it's growing healthy microbiome, which has become a very popular term these days. So the relationship is so much greater now. It's so much more full of life, when we talk about the soil food web. And, for me, it's really enriched my life personally, as I have worked with plants now for 35 years, having this network of community in the soil to now nurture and foster to the betterment of the entire planet. I just love it.
Well, you would have to.
Yeah.
Puts the smile on. Well, let's talk about your CR Medicinal Farm in Costa Rica. You've taken a previously monocropped sugarcane farm and transformed it into a medicinal herb farm. Tell us about the farm itself, when you bought it, the terrain, geology, rainfall, and then we'll get into what you're growing.
So we bought this 45 hectare, almost 100 acre sugarcane farm, which was growing sugarcane for a long time, a couple decades. And we do, whenever I've bought farms before, we do a lot of testing, which include the geology testing. On this one, we dug down 9 feet and we looked at the layers, the geological layers, and we try to establish how much topsoil do we have, and where does the clay layer form, and so forth. So we looked at all of that, and then we measured the phytochemicals in the soil, the nutrients in the soil. We measured for agrochemicals in the soil, and we did our homework, and the whole thing was amazing. This farm had if you were to look at the test results, more organic matter, more nutrient density in the soils to start with, and it made all the sense in the world to use this farm to grow. What I didn't know is how lifeless the soil was. Does that make sense? When I'm talking about lifeless, I'm talking about the biome of the soil.
Right.
I didn't know that it was so lifeless. And I didn't know that the soil was so compacted that, you know how they process sugarcane when it's time to harvest? You know, they go in and they cut the cane and they burn the fields and
right.
cut the cane. So you're essentially, by burning the fields, you're essentially destroying all of the soil food web. And you're destroying all of the essential living entities that bring make the soil aerobic and make the soil right. porous for good drainage. And, you know, so this soil had no capacity to hold water or to manage water erosion. And it was just too compacted. So it was very anaerobic soil. And so that's what we went to work with. You know, it's amazing how quickly you can transform soil.
Yes.
And we did it in some of our fields. You would take this clay-like soil that was so hardened and compacted, and in 1 year, you know, you could go in with your hand and pull up, you know, handfuls of soil and kind of let it trickle through your fingers.
So what did you do?
We applied, firstly, we applied a lot of vermicompost. Do you know what that is? It's compost.
Yes.
It's worm castings.
Yes.
And making compost. We made vermicompost teas. We applied a tremendous amount of other types of compost, lots of organic implements to the soil that encouraged the soil food web population. And then when you grow, a big part of growing in soils like that is a lot of cover cropping to start with, nitrogen
right.
fixing cover cropping, and a lot of intercropping when you grow.
Right. So what are some examples of what you used exactly, please?
So for the cover crop, we used a plant called Mikuna. Actually, every crop we used in this practice was from the legume family. Mikuna seed is it puts out a long vine. It can grow up to 15, 20 feet long. And it's an amazing nitrogen fixer on Mikuna. And then there's another crop we planted called Canavalier. It's another legume. And another crop we planted called Crotalaria, which is sun hemp. And so those three crops were our go-to practice. And all of them are in the legume family, and all of them are nitrogen fixing crops, and all of them go in and start to create the opportunity for producing flocculations in the soil and improving the soil aggregate, which means that we go from a highly compacted, hard clay type soil to a relatively softer soil that's easy to break up. And so by applying all these cover crops first and then these inner crops of these three nitrogen fixers, we were able to really transform the soil very quickly.
Well, I noticed that you did get your certifications very quickly. And so was the sugarcane, had it been grown right up until the time that you bought the farm, or had it been fallow for a while?
It wasn't fallow, but it was the growers were not using agrochemicals for the last 5 years.
Oh, perfect.
Prior to us buying it. That's why we bought it, because we did not find, of the 300 or 400 agrochemicals we tested, we didn't find a trace of any agrochemicals left in the soil. So we felt pretty confident that we could work with this soil.
Yeah.
You know, this is a living experiment. You know, if anybody can preach that it can be done, it can be done. And I've seen it firsthand. And because we started with terrible soil.
Well,
and, you know, it can be done, and it doesn't take forever.
Yes, that's the thing. Going back to 1970, my dad had an apple orchard in upstate New York. And you know, Dad, go organic. And, you know, there's a whole story about that. But the big myth at that time was you can't get the yield, right? They said, oh, you can't go organic because you won't get enough yield to really make your farm profitable. And then fast forward here, for a while, they were saying it would take so many years to create a good soil or to create and start making topsoil, right? But anyone who's really going after it is disproving that as a myth as well.
I'm going to give you a couple of examples.
Please.
This is first year results. Talking about yield, we in our first year before we switched over to regenerative, we yielded about 15,000 kilos of turmeric root per hectare, which is pretty darn good. You know, if you look
PDG.
PDG. And then 1 year of regenerative farming, you know what our yield was?
Oh.
80,000 kilos. So when you mention yield, I'm not so sure I buy the argument that the yield can't be there.
Oh, of course not. No. Dad, are you listening from wherever you are?
We grew holy basil, Tulsi, and for 2 years we grew it. And our yields were about 5,000 kilos per hectare. And in the first year, we got 11,000 kilos per hectare.
Amazing.
It is truly, you know, yields, biomass yields are definitely something that is improved with regenerative farming.
That's really crazy. It's hard to believe, but I believe you. Did you choose turmeric? Was that your first herb that you started growing? And
yeah.
Was there a reason why that you started with one and then branched out? What was your thinking as far as how you introduced the different herbs?
We started with turmeric, and I believe the first year we actually started with turmeric and then some ginger. And, you know, these were commonly grown herbs in this part of Costa Rica.
Right.
So, yeah, we started with those two crops, and then the next year branched out to 8 crops. Now we're growing 11 crops. All of the crops are tropical-loving crops. So, you know, they do well in this tropical
sure.
climate. Yeah.
Isn't young, fresh ginger the most gorgeous thing? It's so beautiful.
I wish I should have brought you one of the big hands of ginger I just brought back from the farm. I should have brought to show the audience here. It's amazing. Especially the variety that we grow here.
Right.
It's called Green Cayman. Mm. It's a large variety and, you know, with large hands. And unlike the ginger coming out of Peru, which is quite small and narrow, hands and fingers.
So what has it been like for the farm workers who you have working there? Did they come from the pesticide-riddled farms? And what was the learning curve and experience for these folks?
Nothing short of amazing and miraculous. You know, they did come from this industry, the sugarcane industry, and they were very excited to use organic practices and to learn a new method of agriculture. We still have most of the same growers.
Bravo, yes.
With us. And, you know, part of what I love about ROC certification, the regenerative certification, is you have to be certified by one of the fair trade organizations. And so in order to get your ROC certification, so we got certified by fair trade, and that overview of certification implies gender equality on the farm. It implies how you treat your workers, how you pay them, what you provide for them in terms of facilities and scheduling and so forth. And so I love that because we employed that kind of attitude and consciousness to our growers
sure.
at Gaia. And certainly I wanted to extend that down here to our growers. So they've all learned a new trade, and I'm proud to say that about 50% of our 27, 28 workers are female. Mm. And, you know, and I just love having, you know, gender equality on our farm.
Yeah, you know, I've just been reading about in Spain where they have these special programs for women to become shepherdesses.
Mm.
It was interesting for me to find out that it was actually, it's been financed by the monies that want to repopulate the rural areas. So they're offering that as a learned skill to women so they can go back to the country and help populate. I thought that was really cool.
It's great. And I think it's what's necessary today. I have a friend who heads up Women of the World organization, and she stands for, you know, finding a place for young women in businesses where they're usually, you know, minimalized by, you know, male CEOs. And, you know, I'm a male CEO, and I have tremendous respect for, you know, women in business and the voice and the intuition of women in business.
Right.
I think critical for the success and the flourishing of a business is to have that softer, quieter clarity of a woman's nervous system, you know, when they can contribute from that level, it's the most powerful place to contribute from in creation. And so I regard it as the most powerful, you know, energy in business. And so I always find a place for it and elevate it to where it rightfully should be.
Lovely. Tell us about the kind of rotational work you do as far as your fields. Do you end up leaving some just with cover crops for a year? Do you do that sort of thing? Do you rotate which herbs and does one follow another?
We don't have a specific sequence, but we do rotate. And down here, fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, you know, we're a 12-month growing
yes.
cycle. So that means if a growing cycle to maturity is 5 or 6 months, we have of one crop, we have 5 or 6 months to plant a cover crop.
Right.
And you so use a cover crop as a rotational crop as well. And that's really nice because, you know, you're continuing to build the soil and build fixed nitrogen in the soil and sequester carbon and so forth.
Nice. What's the most difficult thing about keeping a regenerative operation?
I think, you know, it's not difficult at all, you know, but for us, weed management has been probably the most labor intensive part of the practice of regenerative farming. You know, when you talk about minimal till or no till farming, you know, then you have to have the conversation of what do you do with weeds? And, you know, because you know, to give the audience a little bit of understanding how this is done, you know, with your row crops, we grow in beds, raised beds, but with your row crops, you, rather than till the soil or plow the soils when you harvest, you use what's known as a roller crimper, which means that it's an implement pulled by a tractor and comes and rolls the plant on its side and crimps the stem about 3 inches. So this is as you're doing your harvest, and therefore you're not disturbing the soil, and the debris from the existing plant in the soil falls down and dies and decomposes into the soil right. and builds topsoil. And then you come right over that and plant your cover crop or your next crop. So, you know, and yet you're still going to get weeds, you're going to get grasses, you're going to get, you know, vines and things like that that have to be managed. And to do that, you know, it's about density of the green material, you know, mm-hmm. because weeds are the first succession. They typically don't like shade. And so when you're planting your crops, you plan for how you're going to manage the weeds by growing out the crops to a point where in the first 3 months the you grow it with weed management, and whether it's mulching or composting or whatever. And then after 3 months, you know, the crop itself is tall enough, big enough to shade out the weeds. So there's a way you can do it. It's just, it takes a little bit more partnership with the crop to do it.
Yeah. I just recently saw this film called Wilding. this woman and her husband, they're English, and they had this old estate, and they just decided they wanted it to be its wild self. And after a few years, and they were feeling so great about everything, all of a sudden, all this thistle shows up. And so, of course, everyone in the area is getting all concerned about it. And by law, you have to take care of your thistle or else there'll be heavy fines imposed, etc. And they were feeling like, oh, this experiment, really, we just hit the dead end. We're going to have to go in and do something. And then lo and behold, all these massive amounts of butterflies show up. And they land on the thistle and they start eating all the leaves. The caterpillars and the butterflies take over. And the next year they had no thistle. It's just like this whole magic thing happened, right?
It's a collaboration. If you don't interfere with the healing power of nature, with the wisdom of nature, nature knows best how to organize.
Yeah, I just love that story. Anyway.
It's a beautiful story, Robin. Thanks for sharing it.
Yeah. So before we close, let's touch on supply and demand. You spoke a little bit about it initially when we start talking. And turmeric, for instance, seems to be the darling at the moment, right? Everyone wants turmeric this or that way. And St. John's wort had its day years ago. And I don't know what happened there as far as supply and demand. But is supply keeping up with demand?
I think so far, yes, I can say yes, it is. I think what I'm concerned about is a lot of companies are still, serving the dollar and, trying to find the best prices on supply chain. So they go to China or Indonesia or India. And I have been to China where I have seen organic practices falsified. So my biggest concern is that some of these Asian countries are not being truthful in their organic practices. And I recently read a post about 300 or 400 companies in India losing their organic certification because they were falsifying records. That's a concern for me. And I don't know what this means going forward, truthfulness in supply chain. But I do know by taking it over myself for what we need, I feel it's for me, I know that I'm doing it right. Going forward, I have another concern, and that is the environmental disruption to the supply chain. You know, we've seen periods in time where there's political disruption, where there is economic disruption, and occasionally when we see, floods and things like that, we see environmental disruption. I'm very concerned going forward in the next 10 years, we're going to see a lot more environmental disruption and crop destruction. So that, to me, raises a big question about how is all the supply going to be sustained. I don't know. I think it's probably a good idea to kind of for companies to think about supply chain a little bit more seriously and bring it closer to home.
Right. And especially being in the tropics, when those big, heavy rains start falling, all the topsoil can just go away. And that's why soils become so depleted. So there's no better reason to really work that soil and keep it. Yeah. So it's more like a sponge instead of just a loss.
That's really why, Robin, you don't want to ever leave your soil bare.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
You always want something growing on it because you don't want to lose the erosion factor. You don't want to lose your topsoil. Right. You don't want to lose the soil food web with it.
Yeah. Well, Rick, is there anything glaring right now inside of your head that, oh my gosh, we didn't even talk about this, or why didn't she ask me about that? Or
no, you ask great questions, penetrating questions, and I hope it's a shout out to the emergence of regenerative agriculture in our supply chain. You know, I'm starting a new company now, a new product line, and all these regenerative herbs are going to be dependent on our farm in Costa Rica. Uh-huh. So it's an important conversation to have, you know, with the audience about supply chain and regenerative farming of medicinal plants. So I applaud you for bringing awareness to it.
And are you looking for new and more property to acquire for this new business?
Yes and no. We're just in the process of working with, I don't know how many, I'm going to just say a half a dozen new growers who own their farms but want to grow organically for us and eventually become regenerative certified. So we're building our own cooperative of organic, regenerative, organic growers to help grow the supply chain.
That goes along with everything, right? From the entourage products to working with community. So that's beautiful. Yeah. And you do, we may as well mention, too, that you have a processing plant as well.
Right on the farm. So we have the ability to slice the roots and dry them and do tea bag cut and powder. And now we just built a new facility where we're growing, we're producing fresh ginger for the food industry, you know, selling it into the trade, like, you know, Whole Foods and mm-hmm. other big grocery stores through distributors. So we're supplying that industry now, the ginger and eventually the turmeric product. So that's a new venture for us. And, you know, one of the crops that comes out of India that's never, ever been good quality, it's a crop that's become very popular in the U.S. It's for memory. It's called bacopa. You may have heard of it.
Yes.
Bacopa. But the supply chain for bacopa has been deplorable, and it's contaminated, E. coli contaminated, and yet it makes its way into our industry. And so I developed a method of growing bacopa in the greenhouse using tea frames. And because it's a herb that grows with a long runner. And we are probably the largest producer now of certified organic, regenerative certified bacopa in the U.S., probably in the world. Yeah. So anyway, you know, I just keep the work up and passionate about it.
Rick Scalzo, a force to be reckoned with. Many thanks. He can be reached at crmedicinalfarms.com or Rick, R-I-C, at CocoraLife.com. We can be reached at CultivatedAudio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.